Okay, so I think you probably all know that this week we've been having an urban retreat here at the centre. We've been having the urban retreat on the theme of the Greater Mandala of Aesthetic Appreciation, which is a teaching, of course, from Bhante, which you can find in his book, Wisdom Beyond Words. It's a teaching he gave many years ago, I think in the 1970s, he gave this teaching about a greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. So the phrase aesthetic appreciation translates the Sanskrit word vidya, which is the opposite to avidya, which means ignorance. So aesthetic appreciation is the opposite to ignorance in this translation. This is a translation by a German scholar called Herbert Günther. And Bhante thinks that this translation is a much closer to the real meaning of the term vidya. So this is something for us to think about, that the opposite of ignorance, spiritual ignorance, the opposite of spiritual ignorance is aesthetic appreciation. So appreciation of beauty is being equated with wisdom. So the contrast that's being made, the contrast that Bhante is making, is between seeing things or seeing people or seeing the world in terms of usefulness on the one hand and seeing it in terms of beauty on the other hand. So what's being said is that an enlightened person would see the world, would see things, would see people, would see everything as beautiful, as aesthetically valuable rather than as useful, or rather than in terms of usefulness. So the implication is that we who are not enlightened tend to regard the world in a utilitarian way in terms of usefulness. And another implication is that in order to awake to Buddhahood, in order to attain enlightenment, we need to move in the direction of aesthetic appreciation. We need to move from an attitude of what's in it for me to an attitude of appreciation, simple appreciation. So enlightened consciousness, awakened consciousness, has gone beyond all sense of a permanent, separate, fixed self. It's transcended all sense of self and other. And therefore there's no craving to protect or defend or secure or build up a self, an identity, a me. There's no tendency to regard things or people or the environment or anything in terms of how it can be used to enhance self or to construct self. So this is not to say that an enlightened person doesn't use things. There's a double negative there, I just realized. Anyway, it's not to say that an enlightened person uses things. Of course, some basic things, basic needs need to be fulfilled, yeah? Food, clothing, shelter, medicine, and so on. But all of that is within a much bigger perspective, the perspective of aesthetic appreciation. So this is something we've been hearing throughout the week. We've been talking about this from various different angles. So our state of mind influences how we experience the world. We could even say that when we think we're experiencing the world, what we're really experiencing is our own mind. So when we're in a state of depression, everything around us takes on a particular flavor and is unsatisfactory. When we're in a state of anger, everything around us takes on yet another aspect. When we're in a state of restless craving, everything takes on another feeling. And if we're in love, everything has a rosy hue, or if we've just passed an exam, or if we've just come off retreat or something like that, everything has got a much brighter, rosier hue to it. So our state of mind affects how we see the world, how we experience the world. To a large extent, what we're experiencing is our state of mind. And an enlightened mind experiences the world as beautiful, as a pure land, as they say in the Mahayana tradition. It's a pure land. So in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, which is a Mahayana text, one of the characters in that sutta, Shariputra, he asks a question. He says, if the Buddha field is pure only to the extent that the mind of the Bodhisattva is pure, then when Shakyamuni was engaged in the career of a Bodhisattva, his mind must have been impure. Otherwise, how could this Buddha field appear to be so impure? Good question. Clever kind of question. Anyway, the Buddha replies, Shariputra, the fact that some living beings do not behold the splendid display of virtues of the Buddha field, of the Tathagata, is due to their own ignorance. It's not the fault of the Tathagata, Shariputra. The Buddha field of the Tathagata is pure, but you do not see it. So he's making the same point. It's the what you're experiencing is your mind. It's your state of mind. The text goes on to talk about the work of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva as being to build a Buddha land or build a Buddha field. So, and what it says is that a Buddha land is built of living beings all cooperating together. In other words, a Buddha land is a spiritual community. And the work of every Buddha and Bodhisattva is to build a spiritual community. The spiritual community is a Buddha land, which is a pure land, which is a mandala of aesthetic appreciation. So enlightened consciousness, Buddha mind, you could say, manifests in this mandala of aesthetic appreciation. It manifests as the Buddha land. It manifests as the pure land. It manifests as the spiritual community. So a mandala is a symbol of wholeness. It's a symbol of completeness. And the spiritual community is a mandala of beauty at its best. It's a mandala with commitment to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha at the center of it. And it radiates the beauty of love, the beauty of metta, the beauty of friendship, generosity, wisdom, aesthetic appreciation. So a simple definition of spiritual community is that a spiritual community is a harmonious community of mutual helpfulness with a common objective. A spiritual community is a harmonious community of mutual helpfulness with a common objective. So I'm going to talk about this, a spiritual community in these terms. I'm going to talk about, first of all, the common objective, about the mutual helpfulness, and then about harmony. So the common objective of a spiritual community is to create spiritual community, to create, develop, and maintain a vigorous, vibrant, and effective spiritual community. The purpose of Sangha is Sangha. So this is not to say that the spiritual community is an end in itself, but that it's a necessary condition for the spiritual development of individuals on the path. So everything arises in dependence upon conditions, as we know. And one of the most crucial and indispensable conditions for the arising of awakened consciousness is spiritual community. An awakened or an enlightened mind, a Buddha, transcends all sense of self and other. And the context in which we practice towards this transcendence is Sangha. So in their paper on the suprapersonal force, Bhante and Subhuti talk about it in this way. When people come together who deeply share a common vision and purpose, their efforts combine in a momentum that draws them all forward, beyond themselves. This is Sangha. If they are able to join in real harmony with openness and mutual trust, then the weaknesses of each are obviated and their strengths contribute selflessly to their shared Dharma service. Between them, they set up a powerful current by which they are all simultaneously carried along. So often we begin our spiritual life, our spiritual quest, by thinking in terms of improving ourselves, becoming happier, becoming more relaxed, more confident, and in order to do that, we practice meditation, we try to keep the precepts, we study the Dharma, we engage in puja and so on. And of course it works. It works. We do become happier. We do become more confident, more relaxed and so on. But very quickly we do see the importance of other people. For instance, just the support of meditating with others is quite obvious from the beginning. During the summer, I was leading an introductory Buddhism course, and quite quickly the people on that course noticed that what they were benefiting most from was the other people, the interactions between them, the support they were giving each other. In fact, by the end of it, I felt that actually I wasn't that necessary to it. They were doing it for themselves, yeah. And this week, some of us have been meditating here in the center every morning at 7 o'clock. And I notice I have much better meditation when I meditate with other people. And the more people, the better, as it were. So there were about 20 of us some mornings, and it's fantastic. So people notice this quite early on, that the support of others is helpful. Meditating with others, that's quite obvious. Studying the Dharma with others, you can benefit from hearing different viewpoints and, of course, benefit from greater experience of some others. And when we begin to develop friendships, that also gives us the support and the encouragement that we need to make progress. I just need a drink. So as we progress on the path, we gradually realize that there's much more to the spiritual path than becoming happier, more relaxed and confident. We realize that it's not in fact all about me and my practice, my meditation, my spiritual life, my friends. What we realize is that the whole point of spiritual life is much more expansive. It's much more altruistic. And when we see this, then we begin to realize the real significance of the spiritual community. The spiritual community provides the framework, the context, the institutions, and the opportunities for us to give full expression to the altruistic dimension of spiritual practice. It's where our generosity, our kindness, all our other regarding impulses can be given full expression. And by engaging and participating in the spiritual community, by befriending others, by helping out, by giving time, giving energy, giving money, giving ourselves, we help ourselves to grow and to develop spiritually. We become bigger people, more expansive and alive. And we begin to experience, we begin to taste the bodhisattva life. Yeah, the life of compassionate activity based in awareness. So this practice of spiritual community, it is a practice. This practice of spiritual community is a practice of kusala karma, of skillful action. at ever higher levels. It's increasing all the time, increasing our capacity to give and then giving more and more. And this is how we come eventually to realize the joy of egolessness, the happiness of serving the Dharma wholeheartedly. You could even say the fulfillment of allowing ourselves to be used up for the sake of all living beings. So spiritual community can give rise to what Bhante has called the third order of consciousness. I'll just read you a little description of the third order of consciousness. This is from Subhuti's book about Bhante's teaching. He says, there is no giving up of individual thoughts and feelings to the collective. Rather, individual thoughts and feelings coincide freely and spontaneously. Sharing a common commitment to the three jewels, members of the spiritual community base their lives upon the same ideals and values. They look at the world from the same perspective. Although some, so to speak, view that same perspective from higher altitudes. The third order of consciousness is only collective in this sense. There is, as Sangharakshita puts it, a coincidence of wills. So this coincidence of wills, when this coincidence of wills happens, when something akin to the third order of consciousness arises, it manifests as an atmosphere of cooperation and friendliness. It manifests as a spirit of generosity and goodwill. There's even something quite mysterious and indefinable that we can experience, but we can't quite pin it down. Sometimes people say this when they come to a Buddhist center for the first time. They speak about some atmosphere or something that they can't quite pin down, but it's something different. I remember a few people, again, on that introductory course I was doing, a few people were saying when they came in to the center, they experienced something different from other places they go, and they couldn't quite say what it was. It's this coincidence of wills. It's this indefinable spirit or atmosphere that we generate from people who are all practicing together, sharing the same values, sharing the same ideals. Bhante mentions this. He gave an interview back in 2009 about the nature of the order. And in that he mentions this indefinable something. He says there's something about the movement, the Sri Ratna movement, something about the order that is not easily definable. There is a touch of something that cannot be buttoned down, something that cannot in the end be defined. Even the desire to button it down or define it is a mistake. He says that was the mistake that the Theravada made in connection with their Vinaya. Everyone will need to take care of that rather mysterious, indefinable spirit that gives the movement life and energy. So all this is made possible by the existence of a spiritual community that we can immerse ourselves in. As I said, a spiritual community is a harmonious community of mutual helpfulness with a common objective. And when I say that the common objective of all of us in the spiritual community is to create spiritual community, I don't mean that we're somehow turned in on ourselves and obsessed with our own little group. Creating spiritual community is an expansive outgoing activity. We create spiritual community by being welcoming, friendly, and helpful to all those who wish to be part of it. This is mutual helpfulness. So those who can teach the Dharma, teach. Those whose talents lie in other directions will do other things or support those who teach. And in any case, teaching the Dharma is not really about It's not really talking about the Dharma. It's not about giving talks and giving groups. Really, teaching the Dharma is a matter of exemplification. It's a matter of sharing our experience. At the risk of embarrassing him, I am going to pick out Vimala Bandhu as an example of someone who teaches the Dharma all the time without hardly ever giving talks or leading groups. I've known Vimala Bandhu for 30 years, and he's a very good example of an order member who teaches the Dharma by exemplification. He's consistently generous, good-humoured, and really gives of himself wholeheartedly. He's created this fantastic shrine for us this weekend. He's been working most of the week on it, actually. He's a cook by profession. He cooks for people, not just in Cambridge. He goes all over the movement. Where people need a cook, there goes Vimala Bandhu. Just recently, he was in Germany cooking for an order convention, 80 people. He just gave himself to it. He's 71 years old, by the way. A real example to us, yeah? So the point I'm making is that teaching the Dharma is not necessarily about doing what I'm doing here, giving talks. It's not necessarily about leading groups. It's about exemplifying the Dharma life. And all of us can do that. It's about listening to people, about befriending people who need guidance. Yes, all of us can do that. We can all cooperate together to create and develop the Sangha. We can share our experience. We can be friendly. We can give generously. We can all be examples of a life well lived. So mutual helpfulness is quite a practical thing. For instance, I was thinking about this building. I was thinking if this building could talk. Actually, I'm not quite sure what kind of voice it would have. Probably a big booming voice like Tara Dasa had this morning. Yeah? If this building could talk, what would it say? I think it would say something like, I need your love and attention. I'm old. Yes, I'm 200 years old. I need your love and attention. I need to be kept beautiful. Sometimes I don't function so well. So help me. I think that's what this building would say. I think it would also give 1,000 thanks to all the people who do volunteer and to the centre team who do strive to keep it clean and beautify it and keep it in functioning order. Yeah. So the centre team, the class leaders, the retreat leaders and all our volunteers, the volunteer receptionists, the school visit leaders, all the other volunteers working here, they're all, you could say, working at the coal face of providing the conditions for the spiritual community to flourish. And they all need support, they need encouragement, they need to be rejoiced in, they need to be thanked and praised. So people like Nina, who does our reception, who creates beautiful flower arrangements all around the building every week, others who help with the flowers, I think it's currently Mary and Alison and so on, people like Kenny and Steve, who do reception work for us, Jan and Anne, who do the school visits, Midge and Richard, who do the U3A visits, Anne Blythe, who cleans the toilets in the house over there. Eileen needs to be mentioned. Eileen looks after the allotment and brings us fantastic flowers all summer. And she does such a wonderful job. Tim, Nick, Ian, all these people who help. There's many, many more. There's also all the people, obviously, who teach. Ruchira Ketu, Sagra Ghosh, have been teaching for years here, giving their time freely, volunteering. Prasadamati, Samudra Ghosha, Manjurava, Dayaratna, Vajrasamaya. There's so many people who put their energies in. There's all the Mitra study leaders and so on. Actually, I think Tara Dasa needs a special mention. I don't know if he's here. If he is, I'll embarrass him anyway. Oh, no, he's not. He's gone to Birmingham to do something for the Birmingham Centre. That's why he's not here. Taradasa should be given a medal of honor for the huge amount he puts into keeping this place and everything here running smoothly. And too often, unfortunately, he's on the receiving end of complaints and grumbles. But earlier this year, Taradasa was stretched almost too far. I thought he was on the verge of collapse almost. He was stretched beyond his limits. And I'm really pleased that we were able to get more help in the centre team so that now Taradasa can actually function without being under so much stress. So Taradasa, the whole centre team, Tejas City, Abayamati, they're key to keeping the engines running, so to speak. It can be, I think, quite easy. I've been at Buddhist centres, as Arya Jaya said, for a long time, and it can be quite easy to fall into seeing a Buddhist centre as a service provider, a bit like the post office or the Citizens Advice Bureau or a library or something like that. But a centre is not really about providing a service. It's about facilitating the development of spiritual community. And everybody can be involved in that. Everybody has to be involved in that. Everybody needs to be involved in that. That's how it happens. So you can support those working at the coal face of creating the conditions for spiritual community by giving money, by giving time, by giving energy. Money helps to support the people who keep the show on the road, and it helps to keep this creaking old building in good repair. Giving time to volunteer helps the centre team enormously. There are just so many things that need to be done in a centre. There's manning the reception, cleaning, replacing the flowers, working on the allotment, painting and decorating, looking after shrines, looking after shrine cloths, cleaning candle holders, school visits, supporting classes. There's just so many things that need to be done, and they need to be done all the time. People are going to have to take down all of this at some point, and there's just work involved in everything. Yeah. So there's a whole host of ways in which people do give time, and if more people come forward, then we can do more. We can clean the places we never get to. I was noticing fluff around there this morning when I was making my offering. I thought, oh, we didn't get to sweep that. So yeah, we can we can get all our shrine gear spick and span, and so on. There's so many things. I often think, oh, we've got all these shrine cloths with candle wax on them. We need to do things with them, and so on. From January, actually, Tejas City is going to start a new Friday morning thing here, a kind of Sangha event which will involve meditation and cleaning. And some people will stay on for the study session at lunchtime as well. Anyway, by giving energy to the situation, we create an atmosphere. We create an atmosphere of aliveness that everyone can enjoy. And of course, the primary way to give energy is simply to turn up to events. Last year in a talk, I said that what the Sangha needed was participation, participation, participation. And that's still true. If only five people turned up today, it would be very difficult for me to give a talk. With there's about 50 people here at the moment, and that creates a better buzz, and it's much easier to. Even if I give a very average kind of talk, you'll still enjoy yourselves, you'll enjoy the company of each other. Yeah, so it's better for everyone. People also give energy by getting involved with all the various. There's kind of all sorts of special things that happen here. For instance, quite soon, there's going to be an opera here, and it needs a load of help in the background. Samudra Ghosha is involved in that as well. He's our champion organizer of everything. There's also the winter fair next weekend, which Amala City is looking for people for. There's open days, there's Buddhist Action Month, there's festival days, and so on. Or there's the choir, of course. The choir is always looking for people. Beautiful this morning, by the way. I don't know how many of you heard it. That was absolutely beautiful, the choir. So, Yes, we give energy to the situation simply by doing things together. Whether it's meditating together, going on retreat together, studying together, working together on a project, or just hanging out together. Going to the cinema or an art gallery together. Going for a walk, anything. All this gives energy to the spiritual community. It all helps to create Sangha. It's all helping to build the Buddha land. And in relation to those who are new, we can give hospitality. At the very least, we can give hospitality. We can welcome people and make them feel comfortable. Even if you've only been here twice yourself, you can still welcome someone who's newer. Yeah. I've been to quite a lot of Tri Ratna centres, and I've experienced a lot of friendliness, a lot of hospitality. I don't think Cambridge is at the top of the league, unfortunately. I think we could do better. It can be quite daunting for some people to come into that foyer, come through those doors, and encounter lots of people who already know each other, who are sitting around chatting away. So it's good for all of us to be aware of new people coming into the centre. New means new to you. Even if they're not new, they're new to you. And just make them feel welcome and comfortable. So I've been speaking about giving money, giving time, giving energy under the heading of mutual helpfulness. All giving is good, really. Generosity is the basic Buddhist virtue. That's how Bhante put it. It's the basic Buddhist virtue. And generosity of any kind foreshadows the great compassion of a Buddha. In generosity are the seeds of the Bodhisattva ideal. That aspiration to attain awakening for the sake of all beings. Generosity is not listed as one of the 51 mental events in the Abhidharma. Generosity is an activity. The mental state is one of non-attachment. So non-attachment to our money allows us to give money. Non-attachment to our possessions allows us to give things. Non-attachment to our time, you know, my weekend, my evening, my space, whatever. Non-attachment to time allows us to give time. And non-attachment to our energy allows us to give energy. And non-attachment to our ego identity eventually allows ourselves to give ourselves fully, without even thinking or without even noticing that we are giving. So attachment to this ego identity, this sense of a separate permanent selfhood, is the key delusion. It's the key delusion which the Dharma is designed to undermine. So we can help the process by working on becoming less attached to those things which are extensions of our ego. So our ego is not, our self-identity is not just a thought, not just an idea, it's not just something in our minds. It extends out into the world and it's visible, it's manifest in those things that we are attached to, as it were. So our money, our possessions, our personal space, whatever it is. Putting it more positively, we can help the process of dismantling the delusion of a fixed and separate self by training ourselves in egolessness. And we train ourselves in egolessness through the practice of generosity. So the spiritual community is a harmonious community of mutual helpfulness united by a common objective. I've talked about the common objective of the spiritual community being the creation, development and maintenance of the spiritual community. Building a Buddha land, a pure land, a mandala of aesthetic appreciation. I've spoken about mutual helpfulness in terms of giving money, giving time, giving energy. So that leaves the topic of harmony. The spiritual community is a harmonious community. So what is harmony? Well, according to the dictionary, to be harmonious means to form a pleasing and consistent whole. And this, interestingly enough, is more or less the definition of a mandala that Bhante gives. He says, to make a mandala is to take any prominent aspect of reality and surround it with beauty so as to make a harmonious and pleasing configuration. So a spiritual community, if it is in harmony, is a pleasing and consistent whole. It's a mandala with the three jewels at its center, and those who practice the Dharma or aspire to be awakened are the beauty, as it were, arranged around it. But how do we achieve harmony? How do we take our discordant notes, as it were, and gradually harmonize them into a beautiful mandala? I thought, when I was thinking about this, I thought perhaps we can take a lesson from the choir. We can learn from the choir. How does a group of people with different voices, different ranges, different capacities, different temperaments, different tastes, probably even more difference than that, how does this group gradually become a harmonious singing unit, a choir able to produce beautiful sounds like what we heard this morning? How does that happen? So I don't actually know. I've never been involved with a choir. But what it seems to me is the first thing is that they have to want to be a choir. Yeah, they have to want to come into musical harmony. Yeah. Then they need a choir master. They need a teacher. They need a guide. And they've got a wonderful guide in Artha City. Then they need to be willing to listen to the guide and practice as he or she asks. Yeah? So that seems like a kind of minimum in order to get the choir together. Yeah? Artha City is nodding, so I've got something right there. Yeah? And there may be instances where particular people need individual mentoring to give them confidence. Yes. So, assuming that we all want to be in harmony as a spiritual community, then we need to be willing to listen to our guide, Sangharakshita, and put into practice what he teaches us. Yeah, he teaches us about generosity, about ethics. Well, particularly, I think, in terms of practice the spiritual community, the ethics of speech. The four speech precepts that order members take, I don't think they need to be confined just to order members. Kindly speech, truthful speech, helpful speech, harmonizing speech, speaking well of people behind their backs, that kind of thing. He teaches us a system of practice, a system of meditation, and a system of spiritual practice. He teaches us about study. Maitreya Bandhu was talking about this last Saturday. He was stressing how important study is, how important it is that we study. He was saying the tendency nowadays is for people to take bite-sized bits of this, that, and the other, but not to study in depth. So it's really important that we study. It's important going on retreat. Bhante Sangharakshita has encouraged this right from the beginning, going on retreat. In fact, a lot of the institutions of the movement grew out of people going on retreat together. The communities, for instance, grew out of that experience, because people have a much deeper experience of themselves, but also of the harmony of community on retreat. And of course, there's this central thing that we talk about in the movement of friendship, spiritual friendship, engaging with each other one-to-one, developing friendship. So all of that is the, as it were, the advice, the guidance from our choir master, from our teacher, from our leader, which we need to take on board if we're to create this harmonious community. If we do that, we'll be in harmony. We'll be doing the same practices, having the same language to talk about the practices, and progressing on the path together. Personalities are very different from each other. A bit like voices. Voices are very different. Personalities are very different. But unlike voices, I think, they can't be moulded so easily. I think you can probably get voices to come together more easily than personalities. Sometimes personalities clash. Yeah, they are discordant. And that can be painful and even unpleasant. And in that case, the harmony has to be restored. For the harmony to be restored when personalities clash, I think both parties have to recognize, need to become aware that there is a clash of personalities. And that it's not necessarily about right or wrong. A clash of personalities is just a clash of personalities. Yeah? And if there is that recognition, then some sort of modus operandi, some way of functioning together can usually be agreed. If the discordance is not about personalities, but is about ideas, then that may be much more serious. If the ideas are something that's of great importance to the spiritual life and to spiritual practice, then at some point they have to come into line with whatever the central teaching of our teacher is. If the ideas are not so significant for spiritual life, then one of the or one or other of the clashing parties just has to back down, yeah. Or both of them have to see that the argument has little significance. It's amazing what people can argue over, you know, the slightest thing, the most trivial things sometimes. Anyway, when we have a harmonious spiritual community that's vibrantly alive, that's effective, then, in Bhante's words, we can think of ourselves as living within a greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation, in which all our practical, mundane affairs and the fulfillment of all our non-neurotic needs and wants occupy just a tiny corner. The real values are aesthetic, not utilitarian. Or to put it another way, in the spiritual community, we're in the world of our highest values. And to the extent that we really fully engage in the spiritual community, then the worry and the stress of mundane affairs loses its potency and has less and less of a hold on our imagination. If we fully engage in the spiritual community, we will, in time, have the bigger and wiser perspective of the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. Thank you.